Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. It's Fred Grandy filling in for Frank today. A very important segment on a very important day. This show will probably air sometime right after the Super Committee fails in its budget deliberations, and probably a day before Republican candidates assemble in Washington, D.C. to debate defense and now the impending defense cuts. With that in mind, we're going to be talking about the impact around the world. And our first guest this morning on Secure Freedom Radio is Bruce Klinger. He is a senior research fellow for Northeast Asia and Asian Studies at the Heritage Foundation. I happened to hear Bruce talk about North Korea on Friday. Tried to grab him for the show. He graciously assented, and here he is. Bruce, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Fred.
I wanted to go back to something that you said about North Korea at your presentation last week, because we really have not been paying a lot of attention to that, probably because we've been obviously fixated on the Middle East and elsewhere. But in light of what the president did in his trip to China, you were talking about North Korea now saying that they will probably insist and receive bilateral talks as opposed to six-party talks. Is that a win for them on the global stage?
Yeah, well, right now what's happening is that the U.S. and South Korea have insisted on three preconditions before going back to the six-party talks. They want an improvement in inter-Korean relations. They want a cessation of nuclear activities at the Yongbyon facility, including the return of IAEA inspectors, as well as a North Korean announced moratorium on nuke and missile tests. Since North Korea won't do that, the U.S. and its allies are refusing to go back to the six-party talks, but Washington and Seoul are more willing to engage in bilateral talks with North Korea to try to nudge North Korea back to accepting these preconditions to have the talks. So I think it's more likely we'll have a few more of these bilateral talks. The U.S. is a bit more willing to do that, but I think an actual formal reconvening of the six-party talks is not in the immediate future.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you on Friday, but now is as good a time as any, is where is China in all of this? What is their strategic objective in having North Korea remain a nuclear power and possibly a belligerent one? Is this to some degree a plus for them to have a client state with a nuclear weapon?
Well, for China, the relationship with North Korea is kind of, it's mixed, it's troublesome, and we're even seeing a bit of a generational split in China. On the one hand, mostly the older generation, including in the Politburo, you know, it remembers North Korea as a socialist ally, as a communist ally, an alliance forged in blood during the Korean War, et cetera. So they see the need to maintain North Korea as a buffer zone and supporting them in any way necessary. The younger generation, which still is outvoted by the older generation, you know, sees North Korea as troublesome. They see that the future for China on the peninsula is with South Korea, because China needs to grow about 8% a year in their economy to absorb all the millions of new workers every year. So they see the need to improve relations with South Korea for economic benefits, and they just see North Korea as this albatross around their neck. That said, even though I think China doesn't want a nuclear North Korea, what they want even less than that is an unstable North Korea. So they're unwilling to push North Korea away from its nuclear program, because they don't want any kind of instability on their border, because that just creates a turmoil in the region, and then that even impacts their economy.
All right, let me turn now to South Korea, because you've written extensively about how South Korea is trying to improve through defensive reforms their capabilities against North Korea. And obviously, this is an expensive proposition, but probably in the best of all possible worlds would involve U.S. military investment and defense investment in that. However, with the budget talks collapsing and with defense cuts looming, and at the very minimum, looking like about $600 billion worth of cuts, at least in 2013. How does this impact on South Korea's military strategy? How would this play out in the theater if those cuts actually took effect?
Right. Well, there are a couple of things going on in parallel. On the one hand, South Korea, the plan between the United States and South Korea is that Seoul will regain wartime operational command of its forces in 2015. That's something that they turned over to the U.S. back during the Korean War. They regained the peacetime control of their forces a decade or more ago. So in order to get the wartime operational command, in which the U.S. would then be a supporting command to them, they have to do a number of things. Defense reform, they have to fully fund it. So that's an ongoing procedure, even totally absent from the U.S. defense budget troubles. But obviously the U.S. has to maintain its forces in North Korea and Japan to support that South Korean effort. They still rely on U.S. air power, particularly, but also the U.S. Marine Corps unit that's stationed in Okinawa. That plays a key role in the defense of South Korea. So when you have the U.S. defense cuts, and we've already had hundreds of billions of dollars of cuts even before this whole super committee collapse. So, you know, and that would be levying an additional $600 billion on top of what could already be about $800 billion in cuts. So we're not starting from square one. Secretary of Defense Panetta has vowed that there will be no cuts. It'll have no impact in the Asian theater. President Obama, in his trip to Asia, said that, you know, Asia will remain a priority. But you really wonder if that's possible. If you're going to have that level of cuts, can they keep the level of forces in the Pacific?
Well, not if you look at the sequester requirements written into the Budget Control Act, which essentially says that if these actually take place, they'd have to happen across the board. Now, Congress can revise that next year, but it seems to me what would happen then is various elements of our defense strategy and various theaters around the world would be competing with one another for dollars.
Exactly. And it, even if you were to write into some legislation, we exempt the Pacific, well, then obviously you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. You're making the cuts even disproportionately bigger in the other theaters. And as we do this grand pivot from the Middle East to the Pacific, even though it's great from an Asianist point of view, well, then, you know, the Middle East isn't going to get any quieter or less dangerous just because we're pulling out forces from Iraq and Afghanistan. If anything, perhaps it'll get more dangerous. You know, as a neighborhood, you know, tends to get more dangerous as you reduce the level of policemen in it. And also, if you do the cuts across the board, you're really just hollowing out the force. As you know, the Marine Corps, they increase their strength to deal with Iraq and Afghanistan. They went up to slightly over 200,000 Marines. Now they're talking about going down to 186,000, and with the sequester cuts, maybe 150,000, maybe even 135,000. So, you know, if you're cutting the core that much, it's certainly going to impact your ability, if not in the Pacific, certainly worldwide.
Finally, let me go back to something again you mentioned on Friday, and that is the, and I believe I have this right, there is an election in South Korea, I believe, in December of next year. Is that correct?
There are actually two elections. They are on different cycles for their Congress or their National Assembly. That election, it's a single house, unicameral. That's in April, and then the presidential election is in December.
But right now you have essentially a conservative government, which may lose to a more liberal government. How will that affect the relation between North and South Korea? This particular administration has been a little bit more strident dealing with the North Koreas. Has that been a successful policy, or do South Koreans want to go back to something that's a little bit more, how shall I say, kinder and gentler?
Right. Well, during the 10 years of liberal presidents in South Korea, and they serve a single 5-year term, the relationship with the U.S. became very strained. They had basically a one-way, unconditional, you know, benefit program to North Korea. Once the current president, Lee Myung-bak, who's a conservative, came in office, he developed a very, very strong relationship, not only with the United States, but with George Bush personally, and that even carried over into Barack Obama. So right now, the U.S.-South Korea relationship is about the strongest anyone can remember. if a progressive or liberal government, even just the legislature, comes in April and the trend appears to be in their favor, they would likely adopt a return to the kinder, gentler sunshine policy towards the North. And then I think you're going to have more strains with the U.S. You're going to have differences. South Korea would be pursuing one track, which would be less conditional, less demanding of reciprocity and transparency than the U.S. would. So some of us are unfortunately are nervous that in next year we may be looking back on this year saying, remember when the relationship was so strong with our ally? We hope that's not the case, but it could end up being that way.
All right. Bruce, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio. We've been talking to Bruce Klinger. He is a senior research fellow of Northeast Asia and Asian Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks again, Bruce.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy conducting you around the information battle space today. Frank Gaffney is away on other business, and we welcome to the program. And again, this is a special program because, as you know, by the time this program airs, the super committee may have crashed and burned entirely. Defense cuts will be pending, and tomorrow, Republican candidates will be debating the impact of that. To prepare, we're going to talk to Robert Zarate. He is the policy director at the Foreign Policy Initiative. And, Robert, I'm looking at your piece called Defending Defense, Defense Spending, the Super Committee, and the Price of Greatness. And this is a chilling read, I have to say. But let me just start with something that just jumped out at me. When you say defense spending is the main driver of growing deficit and debt, that is a complete myth. And you point out that over the last 10 years, the U.S. government has spent over $5 trillion more on defense programs than the Congressional Budget Office had originally projected, which means that actually defense is probably the most economically and fiscally sound of all of our discretionary investments.
Yes, sir. Actually, just to clarify, the U.S. government spent $5 trillion more on non-defense programs.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Thanks for clarifying that. Yeah.
Yeah, and no, Today, entitlements such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, they take up 2/3 of the budget. And moreover, over the last, you know, if you take a longer view, over the last few decades, the growth of non-defense programs, in particular entitlements, has been almost exponential. In contrast, defenses remain relatively constant, even in wars. And so at the end of the day, a lot of folks such as Secretary of Defense Panetta, who was a former budget director, as well as the current budget director, and lots of lawmakers, they all recognize that the real fundamental main driver of the debt is our mandatory spending on entitlements. And until we come to grips with that, we can cut defense, cut ourselves very deeply, but we're not going to solve the problem. And what's worse, we'll also make ourselves put ourselves at risk by cutting defense deeply.
Well, that's the logical fiscal and economic argument, but apparently it was the political argument that drove the super committee, which at this point looks as though it will come, as we used to say in Congress, to no resolution thereon. So let me talk a little bit about what happens if the cuts dig as deep as you predict. And as you rightly point out, we're not just talking about $500 billion, which is the one half of the current $1.2 trillion proposed cut, but you say over 10 years this could amount to as much as $1 trillion out of the defense budget. Did I read that correctly?
That is correct, sir. Every year the president puts out a budget, and part of that budget is a decades-long plan as to what he and his administration think we'll spend. And if we use the budget this year as a baseline, effectively as much as $1 trillion will be cut through not only the $500-600 billion in cuts, but also spending caps, which are effectively cuts.
Well, so that begs the question that I wanted to bring up, and you address it as myth number three in your article. And that myth says deep cuts in defense spending won't impact U.S. global leadership. Here's what you say. In order to maintain global leadership, the United States must make commensurate investments in defense of its national security and international interests. If we do not, Robert, could you talk a little bit about what the impact would be on U.S. global leadership, kind of theater by theater? You can start anywhere you want, the Middle East, the Pacific, wherever. But I'd just like to know what this means in terms of diminished U.S. Capacity and leadership in those areas.
Sure. Well, the first thing I'd say is first that these deep defense cuts, these deep sequestration defense cuts, risk turning the United States, which historically has been a global power, into more of a regional power. And because we will have to make pretty big cuts both in our personnel and in our military capabilities, our weapon systems, to accommodate these deep cuts. Now, looking at specific regions, the Middle East. The Middle East is a tinderbox, and under the previous administration, we entered in some wars, and we've started to help establish fledgling democracies there. There's a chance. The region has a chance. But we have countries like Iran, which I think most people would agree is really up to no good when it comes to its nuclear program. We have other countries such as Syria, which had been trying to build a secret nuclear reactor with weapons programs. Our military presence there, which also augments our diplomatic presence throughout the region, is at risk if we make these big cuts. And now moving on to Asia. I should also just add, in the Middle East, too, one of our greatest allies, Israel, we have a very strong interdependent relationship there. And if we have to pull out of that region, we put not only our interests, but also our great friends at risk.
Well, I would also say this would obviously be a clear signal to some of the rogue elements, some of the asymmetric combatants that we've dealt with, such as Hezbollah, Hamas, and Al-Qaeda.
That's absolutely true, sir. Absolutely true. And these sorts of things. By America basically retreating back to its borders, we're emboldening our various enemies. So now moving to Asia, the United States is involved in a lot of commerce with both our friends and states like China, which we don't have good relations with. The United States helps to keep that stable, without the security element there provided by the United States, the stability, a lot of our international trade could go south. A lot of our allies could start to wonder about whether we're committed to them. And this could also, again, embolden our enemies, our potential enemies there, such as the People's Republic of China. China sees the entire Asia region as their backyard. Right now there's sort of a power struggle, and it is, at the end of the day, in the United States' interest to remain involved in Asia because we have a long history there. We've helped turn some states into weak states into powerful friends, and I'm pointing here at the Japanese, the South Koreans. We also have some growing friendships there, the Australians. The Australians have been standing by us shoulder to shoulder throughout the war on terror. They've been in every engagement, every war. So I think we are just putting at risk our larger national security strategy in the Asia-Pacific, which in turn could have a huge blowback.
You know, I wanted to emphasize that point just a little bit more because you pointed out to me before we went on the air that you, like me, an Iowa kid. And,
yes,
you know, if you grew up in Iowa the way I did, you probably remember that defense spending is not a big deal normally in Iowa because we don't have much in the way of defense installations. And when I was a member of Congress, it was popular to beat up on the defense budget because we were always trying to get more dollars for the agricultural budget. But the point that you made about the Pacific is that those trade routes to those countries, those markets, China, Japan, now South Korea, are protected by the U.S. Navy to a large degree and by the U.S. military. Should we stand down there, it's probably a reality that those trade agreements, which are now, I think, redounding to the benefit of Iowa farmers and agricultural interests all over the country, would be in jeopardy.
Yeah, that's correct, sir. That's very much correct. And not only just agricultural trade could be impacted, but also other forms of trade, technology trade, oil. That will be a big one, a lot of oil. Travels through the South China Sea and the straits over there. So it's a big deal.
Then let me kind of conclude with this, because obviously you've talked about two major theaters of U.S. interest, the Middle East and Asia. But the total impact on U.S. global leadership begs another question. If the U.S. stands down and we become, as you suggest, a regional power, that will create a vacuum. Somebody else will have to step in. And who would you say at this point would be the beneficiary on the global stage of the United States beginning to retract its defensive capabilities?
Well, I would say the greatest beneficiaries would be a long line of both potential and real enemies today. The Chinese would, as their wealth grows, they'll certainly want to try to step in. The Russians will... A lot of, as you know, Putin's coming back.
Yes.
And you'll know that he'll want to step on, back on the world stage and make Russia a great power again. And also a lot of our enemies, Iran and as well as terrorist organizations, they will see this as weakness. And if we know anything about, those sorts of enemies, when they smell blood in the water, they're like sharks and they'll attack.
Well, and also, obviously, with China holding so much of our debt, we're at a situation right now where we're essentially sending them our dollars to pay for their own defense. At this point, I would think they would probably quickly figure out how to maximize that investment. Robert, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Robert Zarate. He is the policy director at the Foreign Policy Initiative, talking about the real price of defense cuts. Robert, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
We want to know what you think here at Secure Freedom Radio. Leave your comments or questions for us at 1-800-332-7131. That's 1-800-332-7131.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean... I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion. Realize checks mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. It's not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Effney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This week begins the election process in Egypt, something that will continue until March, and something that we have kept a close eye on, because a lot of what we're hearing and what we're being told by the military government, by supposedly the emerging Arab Spring, the flowering of democracy, is not quite what's going on. And the reason we know that is because we have been talking regularly with Cynthia Farahat. She is an Egyptian political activist, a writer, a former member of a freedom and liberal political party, and unfortunately has had to escape from Egypt, I guess, particularly after the Coptic massacre. Cynthia, you're Coptic yourself, and you join us in the studio right now. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Well, I'm not sure I would put pleasure at this, because what I'm looking at right now is pretty scary. And one of the things that you point out, you wrote a piece in the Middle Eastern Quarterly this summer that we've tried to get to a lot of listeners to this show, but it's very important, because a lot of lawmakers right now and people in our government think there is going to be a standoff between the Muslim Brotherhood, is poised to win, 30%, maybe 40% of the seats in the parliament, and the military. And that standoff will probably create a more democratic Egypt. What you say is exactly the opposite. Tell us why.
Because I don't believe. Sorry, I never believed that the military and the Muslim Brotherhood were separate entities ideologically. They are different organizationally. They are different. They are not the same organization, but they follow the same ideological doctrine. The free officers that started the coup d'etat in Egypt in 1952, almost 80 to 90% of the members were members of the military wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. So, and then they only split the military wing from the civilian wing after the death of Hassan Banna in 1949.
Hassan Banna being the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, after his assassination, the military wing split from the civilian wing, and that's the fight we have today.
But over here, in this part of the world, the impression is that the Muslim Brotherhood is being held at bay by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and a secular government, run now by the military, formerly by President Mubarak, has kept these folks in check. What you're saying is, really, there's been more of a kind of secret partnership that dates back, what, 60 years?
Uh-huh. I think it's not even secret. They've given them, they actually handed them the parliament. Since Sadat, he turned the Muslim Brotherhood into a parliamentary opposition. And Mubarak did the same thing in 2005 to use it as a tactic to scare Western governments of prospects of peaceful transitioning of power. And I don't think that Mubarak's regime was secular, and the current military dictatorship is not secular, as they govern by a Sharia-based constitution.
So what you're saying is essentially a Sharia-compliant government is poised to take over Egypt, whereas a lot of our diplomats and political leaders are saying this will be the beginning of a kind of democratic flowering in the Middle East, starting in Egypt, and of course we've seen similar developments in Tunisia. But the opposite might be true. You might be looking at a much stronger Islamist government with a military capability. You know what you're describing? It almost sounds like Pakistan.
Exactly. That's what it is. That's what this is about.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that after all of our best efforts, after we have invested, I don't know how many billions of dollars in the Egyptian military, mm-hmm. in the Egyptian economy, going back to the original Camp David Accords, mm-hmm. to develop what was supposed to be a democracy, the best we can come up with is a Pakistani model with a military dictatorship underwritten by an Islamist political organization underneath? Is that really what we're looking
at? Precisely. That's precisely what is going on there. And it's even worse. I have spoken to someone before that is very close to the military establishment, and when I asked them after, almost at last March, what kind of example of government they were looking at, he said Sudan and Pakistan.
Oh, Sudan as well.
Sudan as well. So okay. It gets even much worse.
Because I think a lot of people think it would be like Turkey. And right now, a lot of people are inclined to believe that Turkey is the right blend of religion and democracy. I'm not sure I believe that. But to add Pakistan to the mix, to me, is to chill a lot of certainly members of Congress when they have to decide how much funding, particularly the military, should get in Pakistan. Now let me talk about what's happening and what has been happening with the persecution of the cops, principally the October 9th massacre. You pointed out that even though we tend to think there is maybe a population of between 8 and 10 million cops, you say it's closer to 17 million.
Yes.
And you add to that, there are around 6 million, and I use this term loosely, moderate Muslims, Sufi mm-hmm. Muslims, who may not be as Islamist or as Sharia compliant as perhaps the Sunnis that will control the Muslim Brotherhood. Is that right?
Certainly. Not only that, there has been violence, attacks on Sufis from Salafis in Egypt in the past few months. So they are, and also Sufis were very present. They had, their leaders were present in the Coptic protests. So they clearly and publicly proved that, admitted to their alliance with the Copts for a civil state.
Well,
they're terrified of Sharia law.
You know we're not getting this out of the media.
Oh,
either the Egyptian media, the state-run media there, or to that degree, the state-run media over here.
No media would touch this. Because it just changes everything.
Well, obviously, I mean, this is the kind of thing where you have to say to yourself, if we're looking at a government that potentially will be created and then to some degree subsidized by the United States,
mm-hmm.
you're probably looking at greater persecution of religious minorities, cops, moderate Muslims, other sects. Is that what we're looking forward to?
Certainly. Now they have killed cops in a military costume. It doesn't get more obvious than that. With military equipment that they probably got from the U.S. government.
All right, so to some degree...
It's on video. It's on YouTube.
We are aiding and abetting
yes.
a wholesale persecution of a religious minority
certainly.
In contravention of all of the human rights that we supposedly subscribe to.
And not just the religious minority, the moderate Muslims. Like, for example, Ala Abdel Fattah, the blogger that mm-hmm. has been pro-Copts and pro-secularism for years, and he's been in prison before in 2006. Ala Abdel Fattah has been sent to prison because of exposing this. So also moderate Muslims are suffering.
Now, let me ask you, because in full disclosure, I should announce that the Center for Security Policy has been working with Cynthia and her colleagues in Coptic Solidarity International to testify in front of the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission that will be chaired by Congressman Frank Wolf. And that's going to happen hopefully in a couple of weeks. When you get in front of Congressman Wolf, what are you going to ask the United States to do or not do? What can we do to make the situation better for democracy and to end religious persecution of members of the Coptic faith and Sufis as well?
Before yesterday, before the Egyptian Central Security Police massacre and mass murder of Egyptians yesterday in the street, and we have the death toll is raising every single hour because... We have over 700 people injured, and we have 18 people that died.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is a liberal political activist called Walid Rashid. So we have serious problems. Before yesterday, I was going to ask them to make it conditional.
Mm-hmm.
But now, after seeing videos of Central Security Police bragging that they shot a protester in the eye and congratulating each other.
These are military and police... Officials
yes,
bragging about killing cops.
Yes. Oh, no, about killing protester yesterday.
Okay.
And they were also, we have another video where they were bragging about killing cops. And they shoot these videos and they're all over YouTube in their costume with their faces. So I was going to ask that it has to be conditional. But now I don't think America should fund such a regime.
So in other words, what you're saying is we need to stop military aid to the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces
yes,
because it's
until they prove that they are not a jihadist, Islamist kind of government.
Okay. I hope that you will come back and talk to us more about this because this is an ongoing narrative that not a lot of us know about. So, Cynthia, thanks for being with us on the show and to be continued on
it's
Secure Freedom
honor
Radio.
It's an honor to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show.
Well, good morning and out to
school. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Weird. What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Secure Freedom Radio, Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney today. We welcome back to our program Gordon Chang. You probably know he is a columnist at Forbes.com. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China. His most recent book, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. And most recently, Gordon, you've been writing to some extent about what happened over the weekend and what looks to be, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, a kind of change in U.S. policy towards China. What's going on here as you read it?
There's a big shift that's going on. We've seen a number of both rhetorical and substantive changes. So, for instance, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal, which President Obama announced, essentially it does not include China. And it would have been inconceivable just 6 months ago, a year ago, to launch a major free trade area deal without including China. Also, the Pentagon is now announcing its air-sea battle concept, which is really directed to containing China. Secretary Clinton talked about Taiwan being an important security partner. That's a major rhetorical shift. And we saw at the recently completed East Asia Summit in Bali, the United States talking about the South China Sea claims that China has and those claims that are really threatening China's neighbors. So there has been a striking change in the tone of American policy over the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I think that really it's a culmination of many concerns that we've had about Beijing.
By making these gestures right now, and I guess I would also throw in the fact that Secretary Clinton is actually talking about beginning some kind of dialogue with Myanmar, and there are supposedly 2,500 Marines that are now going to Australia. In making all of these gestures, is this administration finally signaling a frustration with China, which has essentially been, we've bent over backwards for China, and if you look at the president, he actually bent forward when dealing with the premier. Do you think that's really changing now, or is this perhaps a gesture towards the president's own constituency in light of a tough re-election himself?
I think that it's really mostly a culmination of really frustration that Washington has felt. The Obama administration came into office, and for the first 2 years, really tried to accommodate China, to placate the Chinese, and went some steps to that. Both the president and Secretary Clinton, and essentially it didn't work. It just made the Chinese more aggressive, and that has really created pushback. It's just natural. So essentially we have not only that dynamic, but also countries in Asia around China's periphery are now much more concerned about Beijing, and so they've been asking Washington for leadership. And as they've asked Washington for leadership, they put pressure on the White House to change. And so I think that this is really a lot of things coming together. And if you believe in the concept of a tipping point, which I do, I think we've just seen it.
All right. What would you anticipate China's reaction to this will be? Let's assume that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is up and operational. Let's assume that 2,500 Marines deploy to Australia, and let's assume that conversations begin with Myanmar and we reassert our partnership with Taiwan. If you were Premier Nguyen, how would you anticipate him reacting to all of this over time?
I think the civilians in Beijing are going to try to maybe move back a little bit because they see resistance in the region. They've been seeing that for quite some time, and they've become maybe a little bit more accommodating. But they don't seem to be calling the shots in Beijing. It's the military. And the military, the flag officers, have just become much more bellicose over the last 2 or 3 years. And so essentially there's going to be an uncoordinated response from China, but on balance, I think it's going to be more aggressive, more hostile, and that's what we've seen. So essentially, as countries in the region react to China, we have to react, and that means that the Chinese military again pushes back. This is not a good scenario, but nonetheless, we have no choice but to exert leadership.
But, of course, you need money to underwrite the leadership, and as this program goes to air, we are looking at what looks to be the collapse of the super committee budget negotiations. And if that happens, then a major sequestration, $500 billion predicted coming out of the defense budget. Do we have the money to put where our mouth seems to be right now vis-a-vis these new initiatives in Asia?
I think that we do, partly because the U.S. military is so overwhelmingly superior at this point. But nonetheless, long term, you raise a very important point because obviously, the military depends upon budgets, and those budgets are going to get smaller, regardless of what happens to the super committee this week. Long term, we do have to be concerned about the funding for the military. There needs to be a shift away from Central Asia and the Middle East to East Asia. That's going to require a different mix of forces. Certainly, we're talking about heavy forces, which are expensive, and this is something that we just have to do. But it is going to be in a period of declining budgets, and we'll just have to be a lot better than we have been.
Gordon, let me ask you something, because obviously you've been tracking U.S. Sino-U.S. relations for a long time. Going back to President Nixon's original meeting with Mao Zedong in 1972 and the attempt by the administration to engage China, which, of course, we have done now for generations, did we go too far with that initiative? Did we wind up in attempting to engage China, overly accommodating them and giving them to some degree a license to become as powerful as they are on the world stage?
Well, in 1972, when we're looking at the Soviet Union as the global adversary, I can understand Nixon and Kissinger's policy. The big mistake was during the first Bush administration, because then the Soviet Union disappeared, and then we continued with the policy of trying to support China. And that didn't work long term, because what we have done, as you point out, is really just strengthened an adversary. As we've engaged the Chinese, we've created perverse incentives. So they've engaged in unfriendly behavior, we rewarded them. So they continued unfriendly conduct, we rewarded them still more. And so there was no incentive for them to be constructive. That's really been the failure of our policy post-Cold War.
But to some degree, weren't we driven by our own economic desires? Because obviously we were the beneficiaries of a lot of cheap consumer goods that are coming from China. And, you know, if you believe what you hear coming out of places like Beijing, some of this is actually some of these products are actually made by people who are in prison, whose human rights have been oppressed. But that, to some degree, seems to have not affected either our political or economic policy towards the People's Republic.
Well, we should reward our friends. In other words, we should try to have our goods manufactured by friends of the United States, our allies, by democracies. Instead, what we have done is we have empowered a hardline authoritarian regime, which is going in all the wrong directions. Over the last 2 years, the trajectory of the Chinese military really has been stunning. They've been talking in public about waging war in the United States, and we act as if that doesn't make a difference, that we continue to maintain vibrant economic relations with China. We shouldn't be doing that with a country that threatens us. And so, therefore, I think we do need to change. Yes, it would be nice to have cheap goods, but we can also have cheap goods and support our friends, and we haven't been doing that.
Very good point. I wanted to ask you, just in the time that we have remaining, about the whole air-sea battle concept that apparently Secretary Clinton has been talking about, and the creation of a new office to that end. How real is Chinese expansionism? And if so, where do they hope to expand? Because the rhetoric has been, at least up to this point, that obviously economic engines were driving the Chinese government and not necessarily military. Now, it seems to be that may be changing.
Chinese expansionism is real. They believe that the South China Sea is an internal Chinese lake. And even worse than that, we've had two flag officers recently, one retired and one currently serving, talking about how the Ryukyu chain, which is part of Japan, really should be China's. This is Okinawa. This is where we have our Kadena Air Force Base, significant U.S. forces. The Chinese also talk about the Russian Far East really being theirs. And then there's all sorts of border conflicts they have with India. So this is a country, China, that really believes that its borders should be much further expanded and China should be much bigger than it is currently. And they're willing to use military force. That's why we see all these hostile editorials in semi-official media. This is a very worrying situation.
So it sounds as though, and we'll have to leave it here, that the Middle Kingdom is not satisfied just with being the middle anymore. We've been talking to Gordon Chang. You can read his columns at Forbes.com or his books, The Coming Collapse of China or Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.